Alrighty, we are in the book of Judges and going through the background of Judges and the first chapter as we did last time. We are now to Judges chapters 2 and 3, which is what we want to get through now. The first chapter of Judges showed that Joshua, during the days of Joshua, the people were faithful. But after his death, the people of Israel failed to actually go in and finish the job of taking the territories that were promised to them, that were allotted to them, and they left many of the people in the lands. Now, one of the reasons for that is because, big reason for that, let's see if anybody remembers or recalls. What? Tribute, the trade routes that ran through there, those were the territories that were harder for them to take because obviously all the other nations that wanted to protect their financial interests and their military interests were on those trade routes all the time. And those were difficult territories then for the people of Israel to occupy and hold. And so the Israelites managed to hold the hill country, and the main trade routes were not usually well taken by them. There were times when they did exercise influence over those trade routes, but largely not, and they were not able to totally eliminate the people from the land. So we go ahead and start our chapter 2, which says in verse 1, "Then the angel of the Lord came up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, 'I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers, and I said, I will never break my covenant with you.'" So here we have, let's start off, first of all, where is Bochim? Bochim is not a term that's often mentioned. And so we'll just get a map up here and show you, if you can see where the map is. They left from Gilgal, which is down here near Jericho on the Jordan River, and went up to Bochim, and most people that speculate say that it may have been Bethel. So they moved up from out of the Jordan into the hill country, up to the area of Bethel, and that was called Bochim. Now, why was it called Bochim? Because in Hebrew that means place of weeping, because that's what they did when they got there. The angel of God told them that they had made a bad mistake in not casting out the people, and now they were going to have to deal with those people for the rest of their days. And so they wept sorely over that. But the angel of God starts off by reminding them that God had been faithful. And look at how he makes this clear to them. "I led you up from Egypt and brought you to the land of which I swore to your fathers." So here he's saying, "I promised your fathers that I would bring you out of Egypt into this land. I did that. You're here. That's testimony. I was faithful to my promise to you." He said, "And I said I would never break my covenant with you." So it's really abundant testimony of God's faithfulness as well as his ability to deliver on his promises. And that's an important thing, because why didn't they succeed in casting out the people of the land? It was a lack of faith. They saw the physical difficulty, the physical challenge. These were strong peoples, these were strong cities, and they just didn't have the faith to fully go in and do what God had said what God had said for them to do. So it was their lack of trust in God, and God starts off by saying, "You can trust in me. I got you here. I got you out of Egypt." So it was a powerful testimony to God's faithfulness as well as to his ability to deliver on his promises that he starts out with here in reminding him of this. He had not failed in his promises to the fathers. He did not and he would not break covenant. He said that he would deliver the land into their hands. But part of that covenant agreement was that Israel would perform what they were required to do, and they didn't. What were they required to do? Verse 2 tells us, "And you shall make no covenant with the inhabitants of this land. You shall tear down their altars." That's what they were supposed to do. And they failed. He said, "But you have not obeyed my voice. Why have you done this?" And that's, of course, what chapter 1 demonstrated all through, was the fact that they had failed to do this. So the consequence then God gives to them of their failure to follow through is in verse 3. "Therefore I also said, I will not drive them out before you, But they shall be thorns in your side, and their gods will be a snare to you. So here they were going to have the land promised to them, given to them, holy. But they failed, the people failed, and so God said, okay, these people are going to be a problem for you for the rest of your days. Their gods are going to be a snare to you. And so it was, verse 4, when the angel of the Lord spoke these words to all the children of Israel, that the people lifted up their voices and wept. And they called the name of that place Bochim, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. And Bochim simply means place of weeping, a mountain west of Gilgal in the hill country where Israel wept because of the angel's pronouncement upon them here. There is no name of a town that has been discovered with that. So, like I say, some people just believe that it was in the area of Bethel, if not Bethel itself. So here God says this is a consequence of their lack of faith. Now, verse 5 says they called the name of the place Bochim, the weepers, and they sacrificed there to the Lord. So they acknowledged and repented. And they did sacrifice. Was it sincere? Who knows? They probably were as much as they were at that time, but does it last? That's always the problem in the book of Judges. Does it last? When Joshua had dismissed, and then there's a flashback here a little bit. When Joshua had dismissed the people, the children of Israel went each to his own inheritance to possess the land. And so the people served the Lord all the days of Joshua and all the days of the elders who outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of the Lord which he had done for Israel. Now Joshua, the son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died when he was 110 years old, and they buried him within the border of his inheritance at Timnath, Heres, in the mountains of Ephraim on the north side of Mount Gash. And when all the generation that had gathered to their fathers, another generation arose after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work which he had done for Israel. So this is a recounting, you could say, of the events through the time of Joshua until the appearing of the angel with the message at Bochim. It's kind of a recounting how they got to this place. It took only how long for the people to fail? It was one generation, wasn't it? All the days of Joshua and those who were with him, they were able to keep strong and faithful. They left the scene, and it was the very next generation. It didn't last very long. The very next generation fell to sin. I think that's a lesson for us, that it's a challenge. It's difficult to pass on the faith. It tends to be hard for the next generation to value as much as the previous generation what it is that God has blessed them with. And we need to be careful, especially second and third generation Christians. It's a wonderful blessing to grow up as a second or third generation Christian, to not have to go through all of the headaches and the horrors of living in the world and suffering the penalties and consequences of those things that, you know, first generations came out of. But it can be a difficult challenge to value it as much, because it's just, you know, familiar. And so the second generation here, they were in the land, and what they grew up with was familiar. They grew up with the Canaanites and the Hittites, and it was just there. And they didn't remember God opening the Jericho and doing all of the other things that God had done. And so that familiarity and that lack of zeal caused them, I think, to start falling away very quickly. So I think there's a lesson there for us. It's difficult to pass on the faith and to pass on the same type of zeal and commitment and dedication. Not impossible by any means. We have many second and third generation Christians in the church today that are wonderful, strong, faithful pillars in the church, and we're all benefited for that. And I count that a great blessing, but it's not always an easy thing. So it only took them one generation to lose it. It's very often for a second generation, so to speak, to allow other things to take precedence over their calling. Verse 11, then the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals, or the Baalim, as they are, plural of Baal. Baal is the principal god of the Phoenicians being on the coastline in the northern territory. And he was worshipped, Baal was worshipped until the time of Samuel, throughout the entire period of the Judges, and on into the time of the kings, through the reign of Ahab in the northern kingdom. There were the prophets of Baal, and that's, of course, who Elijah had that confrontation with on Mount Carmel. Mount Carmel is this point that sticks out into the Mediterranean Sea, that mountain range right there. And so Baal was prominent up in this area of the Phoenicians. The priests of Baal were in very large numbers. There's a symbol of Baal. I don't know why, but Baal is usually pictured with his right arm extended over his head and his left forward. I don't know why, but all of the pictures you see of Baal seem to have that representation for some reason. It's a very common motif. The priests of Baal were in very great numbers and were throughout the time of the judges. They occupied various classes of people. Their mode of offering sacrifices is described in the confrontation with Elijah, and it involved, you know, cutting, ritual cutting, and things like that. The sun god, under the general title of Baal, or Lord, was the chief object of worship of the Canaanites. And each locality had its special Baal. The various local Baals were all summed up under the name of Baalim, or Baals, or lords. And each Baal had a wife, or a consort, who was considered a colorless reflection of himself. And so we also see this consort associated with the female deity of the Sidonians, known as Ashtaroth. And that's mentioned actually in the next verse here as we go to verse 12 and 13. They forsook the Lord God of their fathers who had brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they followed other gods from among the gods of the people who were all around them, and they bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger, and they forsook the Lord and served Baal and the Ashtoreths, or Ashtaroth. And here is, again, you see Baal on the side with a representation of Ashtoreth. In the King James, it's Ashtaroth, A-S-H-T-E-R-O-T-H, which is the plural of Ashtoreth. And where does that come from? It's a name or a title often seen as a consort of Baal. Wikipedia says that the name Ashtaroth was ultimately derived from the second millennium B.C. Phoenician goddess of Astarte, which is the equivalent of the Babylonian Ishtar. And where do we see that name even today? Easter, absolutely. By the way, fertility is the big characteristic, I guess you could say, of Astarte. And when you look for illustrations that are able to be shown in family settings, there are few. So this is the one that I could find that I could actually put on the slides here for you. But in the Bible, the forms Ashtoreth and Ashtaroth are used commonly. The Ashtaroth was directly transliterated into early Greek and Latin versions of the Bible, where it was less apparent that it was a feminine form of the Hebrew word. And so it came to be associated with a masculine demon, as it came to be. And as we look at demonology, modern demonology today, and even in Hebrew texts, from the time of like the 1400s and the 1500s, Ashtaroth or Astaroth came to be thought of as a male demon. And in 1458, in the Hebrew, it has since that time it's occurred in occult texts in the centuries following. And Ashtaroth is now thought of as an arch demon, even in the Hebrew Kabbalic texts, the spiritualists' texts of the Hebrew writings. So it's funny how it changes from a feminine into a male demon now, the Prince of Hell, as he's known today. So it's kind of morphed in modern society, but this is an ancient god that even has modern worshipers today. So that's the Ashtaroth and the Baal. These were problems for the people of Israel and even continued today. Verse 14, and the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and so he delivered them into the hands of plunderers who despoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies all around so that they could no longer stand before their enemies. Verse 15, wherever they went out, the hand of the Lord was against them for calamity, as the Lord had said and as the Lord had sworn to them, and they were greatly distressed. Now, why was it that everywhere they turned they had problems? Why was it? And why wasn't God with them? Because they'd done evil. I mean, he said, yeah, you know, I'll be with you. These are my promises. I'll be faithful to my promises to you. But you've got your part to play. If you don't play your part, how do I draw your attention to it? That you're failing in your part. You're going to have problems. And so this, even in the world tomorrow, when Christ rules, the nations that don't come up to keep the feasts are not going to have rain. I mean, there's got to be some consequence of not following God. And so this was their consequence. Everywhere they went, they had problems. It was a way to get their attention and hopefully get them stirred back up onto the right path. And so they were greatly distressed. And verse 16 says, nevertheless, the Lord raised up judges who delivered them out of the hand of those who plundered them. And yet they would not listen to their judges, but they played the harlot with other gods, and they bowed down to them, and they turned quickly from the way in which their fathers walked in obeying the commandments of the Lord. They did not do so. It's amazing. The whole summary of the book of Judges can be put in this four-phrase refrain, the four S's, which we reviewed last time. The people fall into sin, and then they end up in servitude. That's the consequence. And then they cry out for a deliverer. They supplicate God for a deliverer. And so he sends a savior. The four S's. And they rejoice in the savior, and they have peace for a time. And then what happens next? They go back to the sin, and we have this cycle that repeats throughout the book of Judges. It's amazing, isn't it? Sin, servitude, supplication, and then God sends a savior. God shows how willing he is to forgive and to work with us by how many times he continued to send a savior. I think that's encouraging to us that even though we fall down, even though we make mistakes, even though we sin again and again, when we repent, God has demonstrated his faithfulness and his desire to restore us. Even through the book of Judges, he shows continually his willingness to intervene, to send a deliverer. Unfortunately, we see the people of Israel constantly not sticking with it. And I hope that, you know, while we recognize that God is patient and repeatedly gives opportunity, that we don't make the same mistake of constantly falling away again. When we do sin, we can take encouragement from the faithfulness of God. But we should also take as the example that we should not follow of continually abusing that faithfulness of God by falling back into sin too easily. So I think there's a lesson for us today that we can be encouraged and yet also warned. Because the warning for the judges, you know, as faithful as God was, it wasn't without end. Eventually there came a time when captivity was allowed on the people of Israel. But it was a long, long time. God is merciful. Verse 18, and when the Lord raised up judges for them, the Lord was with the judge, and he delivered them out of the hand of their enemies all the days of the judge. For the Lord was moved to pity by their groaning because of those who oppressed them and harassed them. And it came to pass when the judge was dead that they reverted and behaved more corruptly than their fathers by following other gods to serve them and bow down to them. They did not cease from their own doings nor from their stubborn way. and their anger. And then the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he said, because this nation has transgressed my covenant which I commanded their fathers and has not heeded my voice, I also will no longer drive out before them any of the nations which Joshua left when he died, so that through them I may test Israel, whether they will keep the ways of the Lord, to walk in them as their fathers kept them or not. Therefore the Lord left those nations without driving them out immediately, nor did he deliver them into the hand of Joshua. All right, let's summarize. So God leaves these people in the land. Why? It was, in one sense, it was a penalty, it was a punishment, a consequence of their failure, but it was then also an ongoing test for them. He would test them throughout the future by their presence. It was a test of the people of Israel. And I wonder, has God allowed something similar for us today? You know, modern Israel today. Are there nations, are there peoples that have been a plague to modern Israel? Sure have, right? Are they like a test for us too? I think so. What about, is there a test for us today in his church? Are there things that we wish we didn't have to deal with? Just like Israel wished they didn't have to deal with the Philistines and the Hittites and all of them. But they did. Are there things we wish we didn't have to deal with in our lives? Sure, probably lots and lots of them. And God allows them to continue. Why? I think it's for the same reason. Because they're a test for us. You know, the people of Israel could have strengthened themselves against those tests and grown. And so too can we. And so too should we. And that's our challenge, isn't it? We deal with constant struggle against obstacles in order to be tested and proven over and over again, to be proven. That word test or assay, you know, when you test metal to see the purity of the metal, it's like a trial that you put that metal through. But it's a test of purity, a test of the strength of that metal. And God does the same things for us. So our trials are the things that he allows to continue are a test of our metal, so to speak. They're there to help purify and test us, approve us. So Israel was going to have to just live with this. God was not going to remove them from the land. They would have to learn how to live with it. And so then we have the rest of the book, how the people of Israel dealt with these things and were faithful or not to God. Chapter 3, verse 1. Now these are the nations which the Lord left, that he might test Israel by them, that is, all who had not known any of the wars in Canaan. So this is that new generation that came along. This was only so that the generation of the children of Israel might be taught to know war, at least those who had not formerly known it. Each generation, it seems, needs to learn the same hard lessons, unfortunately, the same hard way. Why can't we just be wise and learn from those who have gone before us and not have to repeat the same mistakes over and over again? You know, what's the old saying? He who doesn't know history is doomed to repeat it. Well, even those that know history still have to repeat it. Why? I mean, it's this, I wish it were different. And God says continually, you know, that it should be different. It's Proverbs chapter 22. It says, a prudent man foresees the evil and hides himself. But the simple or the foolish just pass on and they're the ones that get punished because of it. You know, we should be able to see from experience and from the lessons of others and learn from it and not make the same mistakes. Boy, would we be a lot better off if we did. We would be the prudent. We would be the wise if we did that. And yet, generation after generation, people after people, we seem like we have to make the same mistakes and prove it all over again for ourselves. It's twice it says this in Proverbs, chapter 22, verse 3, and again in chapter 27, verse 12. You know, it's an important point. And it's not like God doesn't send warnings, because he certainly does. It's a great great blessing, for example, to grow up in the church and to learn from the generation that has gone before, to stay in the church and to miss all of the pain and the agony of living the ways of this world. We don't have to go through that if we will simply be prudent and wise and learn. But unfortunately, the generations in times of the judges, and too many of us today, have to learn all over again. God continually provides examples for us to be able to learn from. He continually instructs us so that we don't have to suffer needlessly. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 tells us that all these things happen to them as examples. And it's written for our warning on whom the ends of the world. We don't have to follow the negative trajectory of all of those that have gone before. We shouldn't have to. Unfortunately, often we do. Deuteronomy chapter 30, the blessings and cursings chapters. God says, I lay before you life and death. Choose life. But he lays it all out there before us. It's not like we don't know and don't have the examples and don't have the instructions. But we follow continually to have to learn from experience. The judges, the days of the judges, they continually had to learn from experience. It seems every generation did. Hopefully we can do better than that. Verse 3, among those that were there to be kept as a test, it says, were the five lords of the Philistines, all of the Canaanites, the Sidonians, and the Hivites who dwelt in Mount Lebanon, from Mount Baal Hermon to the entrance of Hamath. And they were left that he might test Israel by them to know whether they would obey the commandments of the Lord which he had commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. So why does God allow trials on us? To prove us, to test us, just like them. I certainly hope we do better than they do. Verse 5, thus the children of Israel dwelt among the Canaanites and the Hittites and the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. And they took their daughters to be their wives and gave their daughters to their sons, and they served their gods. And so the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and they forgot the Lord their God, and they served the Baals and the Asherahs. In some translations, like the Old King James, it says, and they served the Baals and the groves. Groves, Asherah, interchangeable words there. I think it's Asherah is better. The idols were often worshipped in groves. They had groves dedicated to them, but it's really the idols themselves that they were worshipping. Verse 8. Let's get up to now the first judge that we actually see come on the scene. Therefore, the anger of the Lord was hot against Israel, and he sold them into the hand of Cushan-Rishathaim, the king of Mesopotamia. And the children of Israel served Cushan-Rishathaim for 8 years. This is the first test now, and we're going to be introduced to the first judge. Cushan-Rishathaim means twice wicked Cushan. How'd you like to be known as twice wicked Cushan? He came from Mesopotamia. Now, where is Mesopotamia? What do we call the area of Mesopotamia today? What is it? Around Babylon, exactly. Mesopotamia, meso means between. It's talking about between the two rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates. Where are those? That's the area we call today Iraq. So it would have been far over this area, on this map. And so they would have probably come in along trade routes that would come in through the north, through Megiddo, and then run along the seacoast down toward Egypt. But they also had subordinate routes that went across through Judah and then down through the Negev and toward the Dead Sea, or the Red Sea and Jordan and so on. So there were a multitude of trade routes that were involved that they could have come in on, either from the north or from the south. Now, Othniel is going to be the judge that God raises up. Othniel is related to Caleb, and he's in the south, in the area of Judah. So the three judges we're going to look at today are Othniel, Ehud, and Shamgar. I don't know why they put Shamgar way up here. I think he was probably farther in the south, but it's not clear in the scriptures. So in this map, they happen to put him way in the north. But we're here in this section going to be talking about Othniel. So Cushan-Rishathaim, leader from Mesopotamia, came in and afflicted the people for 8 years. Verse 9, when the children of Israel cried to the Lord raised a deliverer for the children of Israel who delivered them, Othniel, the son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother. So we're reintroduced to Othniel. We saw him in actually chapter 1, where he was introduced to us as, I think, a way of foreshadowing who was to come on as the scene as the first of the judges. Othniel is the son of Caleb's younger brother, Kenaz. And he's also Caleb's son-in-law, as it turns out. And he is a man, therefore, of some note in the community. He is a mighty man of valor, so to speak. He's not some, you know, small-time shepherd. He's from a notable family. He's a man of reputation. And he's living in the tribal territory of Judah. Very little is said about this oppression from twice wicked Cushan. We don't know a lot about it, but we can presume that it affected the tribal area that Othniel came from, Judah in the south. At least that area predominantly, though it might have been much more general in nature, again, because from Mesopotamia they would likely have come in from the north and would have affected other tribes in that area as well. But the primary trade routes would have likely been affected. Verse 10, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him, and he judged Israel, and he went out to war, and the Lord delivered Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Mesopotamia, into his hand, and his hand prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim, and so the land had rest for 40 years, and then Othniel, the son of Kenaz, died. And that's all we have to know. We got more about Othniel in the introduction to him in chapter 1, I think, than we actually got in the story of him as a judge, other than that he succeeded in throwing off this oppression. And he ruled as judge for 40 years, and there was peace for that period of time. So while little is said, his judgeship is obviously very successful as long as he lives, 40 years of peace. And then he died, and guess what happened? Verse 12, and the children of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord, and so the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel, because they had done evil in the sight of the Lord. Eglon, his name means calf-like. I don't know why he's called calf-like. I can only guess. We know that Eglon was a very fat man. So whether he was called calf-like because of his size, I don't know. But that's, you know, simply supposition. Maybe he was as fat as a cow. Who knows? But in any case, he was from, that's not the slide that I want. He was from Moab, which is across the Dead Sea from the tribal area of Judah, just south of Reuben. So here's the Dead Sea, here's Moab. God raised up, or God allowed Eglon to become strong. And it says in verse, if he ruled in Moab, then his influence would have been up through the territory of Reuben, into the southern portion of Gad, and he would have controlled across the fords of the Jordan River down by Jericho, and would have had influence into the area of Ephraim and Benjamin and Judah. That's how he would have spread his influence. So verse 13 says, then he gathered to himself the people of Ammon and Amalek and went and defeated Israel and took possession of the city of Palms. Ammon is located here. So here's the king of Moab, and he associates with Ammon, and the people of Amalek are the descendants of Esau in Edom. So he was the leader of a coalition of peoples across the Jordan, and it would have influenced this entire area. And then it says he took the city of Palms. Now, where is the city of Palms? We talked about that last time. Jericho, exactly. Why would he have taken that location? Trade routes, but more importantly, it's a fording place. It's a crossing place because the territory north gets very steep And so if you're going to cross the Jordan, this is a good place to do it. So if you're going to have an incursion into Israel, you need to hold this area around the city of palms because that's where the fords of the Jordan are located. So it's no surprise that the city of palms is mentioned here. It was probably a militarily important location to control. So the children of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. But when the children of Israel cried out to the Lord raised up a deliverer for them, Ehud, son of Gera, the Benjamite, a left-handed man. And by him the children of Israel sent tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab. So it's specifically mentioned that he's left-handed. Why would they mention something like that? That seems like an odd thing to note. I mean, how important is it that you're left-handed? Benjamites were, a lot of them were left-handed. They were known as left-handed individuals, and as a matter of fact, they had a reputation as being expert left-handed slingers. They could use a sling with the left hand and the right hand equally well, though it made them pretty dominant in warfare at that time. But they could hit, you know, a mark from a good distance, and they were left-handed. So this is a common trait of the Benjamites, this left-handedness, and they were noted for it, as I say, in certain other areas. You can read in Judges chapter 20, for example, it mentions it in verse 16. Also 1 Chronicles chapter 12, verse 2, where it mentions that they were left-handed slingers. But Ehud was the one that was selected to bring the tribute, which would mean that Ehud was probably, what would you say, prince or a pauper? Probably a prince. I mean, you're not going to send a person of low class to the person you're sending tribute to. That would be an affront. That would be an offense, and so it wouldn't be received well. You send somebody who is of note to carry the tribute to the superior that you're bringing this to. So this is an indication that Ehud is, again, somebody of reputation. So the first two judges we find are of the, you could say, the higher classes in Israel. They were of the more reputable classes. That isn't always the case. As we read through the book of Judges, we're going to find that he raises up people that were essentially scoundrels, viewed that way by other people. And I think that's a lesson for us as well, that if God's going to raise up somebody as a judge or whatever, he can use anyone. And we shouldn't just look at status and rank and height. We need to look at character. We need to look at the things that God sees, and not fall prey, like I say, to just what have they accomplished or what has their family accomplished. We need to look at character. So now Ehud, it says in verse 16, made himself a dagger. It was double-edged and a cubit in length, or about 18 inches long, and he fastened it under his clothes on his right thigh. Why is that significant? He was left-handed, so he would reach across to reach the dagger, which was under his right thigh. Now, most people in those days were not left-handed. So if you were going to see the king and you were going to get a pat down, what side would they pat down? They would pat down the left side because you're right-handed, you're going to reach across on that side. That's where you would carry your sword and things like that. So it was probably, he was left-handed, he could get away with hiding this dagger in a place where they wouldn't normally look for it. And therefore he would be able to get into the presence of the king, Eglon, with the dagger hidden and undetected. So it was important that he was left-handed in this case. So he brought the tribute to Eglon, the king of Moab, and now Eglon, it says, was a very fat man. And when he had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who had carried the tribute. He brought this to him down in the territory of Jericho. This is where he was located. Verse 19, but he himself turned back from the stone images that were at Gilgal, and he said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And he said, keep silence, and all who attended him went out from him. So if we get this picture, here he is, he's in the king's residence there. in the city of Palms, in the territory of Gilgal, and Ehud brings him the tribute, and then when they start going away, he sends everybody away, and he turns back to the king, and he says, I have something to tell you. I have a secret. And so the king sends away his own advisors, because this is now a personal conference that he's going to have with this prince from Israel. Again, it's an indication of Ehud's status. Why would he do this unless he wasn't a person of note? You're not going to just send away all your own personal advisors and listen to a nobody. But he recognizes Ehud, and so maybe he thinks he's going to get some military intelligence from Ehud or something like that. I've got a secret to tell you here, Eglon. And so they're in the chamber alone, just the two of them now. And so probably thinking he's going to get some military intelligence or something like that. So, verse 20, Ehud came to him. Now he was sitting upstairs in his cool private chamber. And then Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And so he arose from his seat. Eglon got up from his seat. And then Ehud reached with his left hand, took the dagger from his right thigh, and he thrust it into his belly. Even the hilt went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade, for he did not draw the dagger out of his belly, and his entrails came out. That's a pretty gory picture. But, you know, the Bible doesn't sugarcoat things. Can you imagine how fat this guy was, though? Anyway, then Ehud went out through the porch and shut the doors of the upper room behind him, and he locked them. So he was here all alone. He kills Eglon, locks his private chamber doors, and he skedaddles. He'd already sent his entourage out ahead of him. And so, verse 24, when he had gone out, Eglon's servants came to look, and to their surprise, the doors of the upper room were locked. And so they said, oh, well, he's probably attending to his needs in the cool chamber. You know, eating or something. And so they waited until they were embarrassed. Whatever he ate apparently made him pretty constipated or whatever, who knows. But they were embarrassed in how long he was taking in his private chamber. And still they didn't open the doors of the upper room. And therefore they took the key and they opened them. And there they found him fallen dead on the floor. It's kind of funny, isn't it? You know, what's in their heads and why they're not going to do something. He needs his privacy for now, and wait, something they realized was finally wrong. So then Ehud, verse 26, by that time had escaped while they delayed, and he passed beyond the stone images and escaped to a place called Seirah. Where is Seirah? It's speculated that it's a district of woody hills up here in the area of the hill country in the mountains of Ephraim that bordered on the tribe of Benjamin. So, you know, they must have waited a long time for Eglon to do what he needed to do before to allow Ehud to escape the distance he needed to get away. But what he did when he got to this height of Seirah, it happened when he arrived there that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. So how much of this was planned in advance to where there were people that were ready to hear the trumpet sound? It seems like he probably coordinated some of this. It's not like all of a sudden he has this idea and he exercises this completely alone. There was probably some forethought and planning to this is what we can presume. And so he flees from Jericho, where he had killed Eglon, goes up into Seirah in the mountains of Ephraim, the border territory with Benjamin, blows the trumpet, and the people respond from that territory. And what we're going to find is they respond, and the first thing they do is they take the fords at the river. So, verse 27. It happened when he arrived that he blew the trumpet in the mountains of Ephraim, and the children of Israel went down with him from the mountains, and he led them. And he said to them, follow me, for the Lord has delivered your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. And so they went down after him, seized the fords of the Jordan leading to Moab, and did not allow anyone to cross over. Why was that important that they seized the fords of the Jordan? Wouldn't you want them to just run away? They were going to trap them. That's what they were going to do. They were going to be in the plains there, and they were going to be, and the Israelites were coming out of the mountains, and the Moabites would be exposed and surprised, and they would be easy pickings for the Israelites. And verse 29, at that time they killed about 10,000 men of Moab, all stout men of valor, not a man escaped, because they took the fords and they couldn't cross the Jordan. They'd blocked them. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land of, had rest for 80 years. That's a long time. They were tremendously blessed after this. And then it says in verse 31 that after him was Shamgar, the son of Anath, who killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad, and he also delivered Israel. So one verse. That's how much is given to the third judge of Israel, Shamgar. I always think of that commercial, ShamWow, whenever I see his name. Shamgar, the son of Anath, killed 600 men of the Philistines with an ox goad. So the next struggle was not against the Moabites or the people across the Jordan, but it came from the coastline of the Mediterranean Sea where the Philistines were. They had infiltrated into the upland country, and that's why I think Shamgar was misplaced on that other map where it showed him far to the north. The Philistines were not up in this territory. The Philistines were along this coastal plain area, and so I suspect it was more down into this hill country where Shamgar was located. Again, we don't know anything more about him than what we read here in this one verse, so not a lot that's said. What is said is that he used what as his weapon? An ox goad, right? What is an ox goad? It's a sharp pointed stick. Now, in truth, these ox goads could be about 10 feet long, in the longest case, so it was more like a spear, I guess you could say. But he used it, whatever it was, this pointed stick, to kill 600 Philistines. That's remarkable. And I think that teaches us a lesson that we read later in 1 Samuel. Let's just refer back over here. 1 Samuel chapter 14. Excuse me. 1 Samuel chapter 14 and verse 6. In this case, Jonathan is with his armor bearer, and they're facing the Philistines. This is many, many years after the time of Shamgar, obviously, during the time of King Saul. But they're still having problems with the Philistines. And they're in a stalemate with them. The Philistines hold a significant key location. Jonathan is frustrated because his father's not doing anything. And he says to his servant, you know what? Let's you and me go over to this place and let's see what we can do. And he says in verse 4, 1 Samuel 14, verse 6, I'm sorry. Jonathan said to the young man who bore his armor, come, let us go over to the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us, for nothing restrains the Lord from saving by many or by few. If it's God who's going to be behind it, it doesn't matter. If you're 2 or 200, it doesn't make a difference. And Jonathan had that faith. And so Jonathan and his armor bearer were successful in defeating the garrison of the Philistines. Just like Shamgar was successful in defeating 600 of the Philistines with nothing more than an ox goad. Now the Philistines, people of the plain, were known to have chariots and iron. And Shamgar dealt with them with a stick. God was obviously there. And so Samson is another judge who later slew 1,000 people with the jawbone of a donkey. Was God the one who blessed him, made that possible? You bet. So the odds, we have to recognize, are always in God's favor, no matter what the physical circumstances look like. The odds are always in God's favor, no matter what man sees. If you have faith, you have courage, and you take action on it, Jonathan took action. Shamgar took action. We have to take action on our faith and trust God to do what only He can do. God has always looked for people of action. The judges were those who took action. So let's look at these first three of the judges in chapter 3 here and see if we can't kind of summarize and take key lessons for us that would apply for us even today. The first one, Othniel, what do we know about how he was used by God and how he brought deliverance? Very little is said other than that he rose up and he took action and he defeated twice wicked Cushan. And that's about all we know. Are there lessons that we can take from that? It's just a small little section. Other than the fact that he took action, he did something. He was a person of some reputation, and so it was a logical thing for him to do something. I think that we need to recognize sometimes when God puts us in a place where we can influence or we can exercise godly means, we need to do it. When Mordecai went to Queen Esther and said, "Who knows if God hasn't put you in a place for time such as this?" You know, and so she had to do something. There comes a time for us to take action. And we need to recognize when that time is and do it and trust God to bear the good fruit. I think that's the lesson that we take from all three of these. When the time to take action is there, you take the action and trust God to bear the fruit. Othniel used whatever reputation or influence he had to be able to do that. Ehud did the same. He saw an opportunity that he had because he was the one that could bring the tribute. And he used his position, his rank, his place in order to do what he needed to do. He didn't sit back and do nothing. He obviously planned it out. He had some kind of planning that he coordinated with others, I think. That seems to be evident. But he took action. He used the opportunity that came to him to do what he needed to do. The one thing that we can see from this last story of Shamgar is that he didn't wait for some time to get better munitions. Whatever it was that he recognized was the right time to take action, he did it, even if it was with just an ox goad. And God blessed it. So to me, as I look at these first three, the lesson that I can take from all of these is to take action, to not be idle or passive with what God gives us to do, but to trust God and it will work out. Think about Ehud going into Eglon's private chambers. You know you had to infiltrate with an 18-inch long dagger. That was your only weapon. And when you left your weapon. And yet he was there. Eglon was the king. He had a guard. I mean, it was risky to do what he did. But he did it. He had the courage, he had the faith, and he took action. So if I can summarize a lesson for us today, it's faith, courage, and action. Chapter 3 teaches us to have faith, have courage, and take action. And God will bless it. So we'll wrap up chapters 2 and 3 here, and next time we'll get into chapters 4 and 5, and we get into the rather interesting story of Deborah and Barak, and there's a lot that's in that story for us that we might even take two Bible studies to get through it all. Okay, thank you all very much. It's time to eat.